Is that you, Ed?
This is me. How's it going, Heather?
Going well. Getting ready for the conference.
All right. That's good to hear.
Yeah.
That's what I hear from a lot of people these days. I'm getting ready.
Yeah. Hopefully, yeah. I mean, a few more to-dos.
There's always a few more to-dos.
Well, and Jeremy Johnson, who's president right now, is stuck in a hurricane. So
really,
I just saw this morning. Yeah.
Oh. Okay. Yeah. There always has to be a challenge.
Right. I guess.
So I guess I'm kind of getting excited about the conference, but I'm just finishing up these two grants today and tomorrow. So,
see what I said, Heather? There's always a challenge. I'll tell you, when it rains, it pours.
It does.
Well. You'll master it, sir. I'm sure of it.
Yeah, they're good projects, too. I hope they get funded. Hi, Michael.
Could you give me just one moment to use the restroom and be right back?
Sure. All right. You're the boss.
All right.
So I'm going to add myself twice so that I can share my screen later.
So okay.
Just so you know why I'm here and surround.
Hi, John. How are you doing?
Greetings, everyone. Let me get hooked up here.
Big fly. You said you were going to smile, Mark.
Did I? I don't know what got into it.
What your post said.
Did it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I never read those things.
Yeah, well.
I just do them at 1 o'clock in the morning or something.
In the morning, just kind of throw them out there. Yeah.
Well. How's that? I'm testing out the audio. I got this little tinkle bell.
I heard that.
From my daughters. I also have a cowbell. And I have
very alpine.
I have my regular meditation bell.
Oh.
And I think we need to just talk a little bit logistic technology. Oh, maracas, cool.
Let's go.
I'm
sorry, I'll mute myself.
No, that's cool. So Heather and Jeffrey, I think we need to just check in for a moment and talk kind of backstage, as it were, on a couple of logistical points. So Heather, the presentation at the conference is an hour and a half or 2 hours?
It's 2 hours. Well, 10:20 to 12.
Oh, to 12. Okay.
Yeah, or maybe 10:30 to 12. But there's nothing after us. So if we needed to, even before, after we figured this out today, I could bump that 15 minutes if we needed to.
Okay, the program showed, the program didn't quite add up.
John Dotson pointed out the error. So I had Jeffrey starting at 10:20, which is the end of Glenn's hour-long session.
Okay, so more likely we'd be starting at like 10:30.
Yeah, and I'm not giving people a break. I hope that's okay in the morning too. We start at 9:30, so they only have to pay attention for an hour before our 2 hours.
Okay. Maybe like if there'd be a 10-minute window between, or 5 or 10-minute window for transition between the previous one and our talk.
So I could go ahead and build in a 10-minute break, and that would start us at 10:40. So really, we'll probably go up to around 12:20 or 12:30.
Okay.
Cool.
I hope you will. Will this be recorded tomorrow?
Or it's Sunday.
Oh, it's Sunday. Excuse me. I thought it was starting this week. Okay. Friday. But it'll all be recorded as usual, right?
Yeah. Don't get me panicked, Johnny. Sunday's already. No, I'm not quite ready.
I was there last year when it was in New York, and it was recorded. But the year, and
we're
the
gonna,
year before that,
we're
it was
gonna live stream.
The recording was terrible.
We're and gonna then, live stream it, yeah.
Yeah. The year before that, the recording was very good. So I
it's likely to be terrible again.
No, don't say that.
It's gonna be through Jeremy's laptop with a webcam. And I imagine that's when the year it was terrible, it was a similar setup.
Well, the year it was terrible was the camera was to the side of the room. And everything on the slides was totally, you couldn't see anything. You saw the profile of the speaker and he was pointing to a screen you couldn't see.
We'll avoid that.
Yes, please. Thank you.
Well, I mean, we might be able to, I don't know, work something out even for just our talk because it's a big weekend. We have the Gebster conference starting on Friday. That goes Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Jeffrey, Heather has been coordinating. Co-coordinating the conference with another fellow, Hans, and folks from the Gebster Society. And then Heather, Jeffrey, and I are presenting on Sunday, but the Saturday night before that, we're hosting a poetry reading at Naropa. And so that is just coming together this week. Like that was determined in the last few days, right? And we have been, Heather, Jeffrey, and I have been talking weekly on this quantum field poetics idea and preparing for the presentation, but we've also had a lot of other things going on. So this is all kind of coming together in the last, at the last minute. And this, I'm really glad we're doing this because it really forced, I think, me and perhaps all of us to concretize, to come out of the realm of quantum, possibilities into the actualities of what we're going to present. And so this is a trial run. This is a test. This may be a little bit messy, I think, but it's going to, I think, make our actual presentation at the conference probably a lot better than if we were just to show up.
That's what the cafe is for. It's always a rough rehearsal. So I'm looking forward to this, you guys.
Okay, perfect. So I have a couple more logistical questions. Jeffrey and Heather, do you have any slides or presentations that you are going to be using?
Yes, I'm going to share my screen. You'll see I'm on here twice if you look at the gallery view. So I'm going to share my laptop screen when I get ready for my Prezi.
Gotcha. And Jeffrey?
So I haven't actually got any visuals right now, which is really odd for me because when I present, I always have visuals, even when it's text. But I'm still thinking about something, but it will be very simple. So it'll maybe just be a few slides that will run in the background, and that's it.
Okay.
But I don't have that today.
Okay. So at the conference, we're going to have to work out switching between our various presentations. So, and then in this talk now, I think if we share our screens, we can share our respective presentations, Heather and I. And Jeffrey, during yours, we could just look at you. I could put up a nice picture if you would like. I have a few pieces of art. So the way that we're going to do this is I'm going to lead us off. I'm going to just introduce the overall topic and make the invitation to our audience. And then Jeffrey is going to go first.
Because what I thought I'd do, Marco, since I think I'm running this session, Heather, is that right? At the conference?
It's still undefined, but yes.
What I was going to do is I was sort of going to introduce the session as if we were actually in front of an audience and then introduce each piece as it comes in turn.
Okay.
As if we were in front of the audience. So whatever you do for, you know, this session, Marco, then you could just leave it to me and I'll run it as if we're actually at the conference.
Okay, so what I had in mind was more of a meta introduction, like not to the content of quantum or field poetics, but more an invitation to the audience to kind of go on this journey with us, particularly with the ideas of sensing the field, holding the field, and carrying the field. If you were gonna introduce those topics,
I hadn't. It's a good idea, but I haven't got that far.
Right, and we talked about that on our last call, as I remember, and I said Marco can do that.
Oh, maybe Marco can do the whole thing. That would be great.
Well, but I think maybe Jeffrey, you could introduce the content for the three. So I was actually imagining Marco's piece coming between the presentations and the end, but we do have to have the audience oriented to pay attention to the field. So it makes sense in this order, doesn't it? A little bit, Jeffrey?
It makes sense. It's just that for the general intro, I'd be happy if Marco could even do it at the conference without.
Well, let's try it.
Anyway, so we can work that out.
Something a little bit in mind. We can try it. Okay. I'm not going to go into content. So I will leave that to you.
Okay.
To begin with, and then to do your presentation, and then to Heather. And then I have mine, which I will, you know, which will run through. And mine will open into the next part of the event, where we're inviting our audience to respond and to participate. So I'll really just leave off there. And I'm going to read a poem that will, I hope, invite people to respond. But not just to the poem, really to the whole arc of our presentations, to the three gestures of our presentations. So does that all sound good? Make sense?
Yep.
Okay. Then I'm going to share my screen. And unless there are any questions, we could get started. Yeah? Cool. So let me know if you see that. Okay.
Yeah.
All this there's a few pieces of art I've put in here. It's it hasn't been really well considered. It's just things that I found. So
The only problem is it's taking my full screen, and I will need to see my text when I get to my piece.
Jeffrey, you can do a small, if you, so on the side, I have three options at the top of the video screens. I don't know what you're seeing right now. It says show small active speaker video. It collapses it to one video at a time.
There we go.
I can't see that. So tiny.
Wherever you see the videos displayed, if are they in a column or are they in tiles? What do you see?
I mean, what I have is the whole, my whole screen has gone to Marco's image, but there's no way to miniaturize. If I click on the links, it just deals with the videos and not with the full screen.
How about when it's your turn, I'll stop sharing my screen so that you can see whatever you have in front of you.
I could send it to my iPad. But I need to have access to my screen to do that. So you'll have to unhook the full screen. Anyway, sorry.
Okay.
I don't know how to. Maybe there is another way. Oh, wait a moment. I have
it. At the top of the Zoom window, there's a view options, and you can leave full screen, and it will.
Oh, I've got it now. I was just, but I will send it to my iPad, I think.
That's what I did. So I'll be sharing my screen and have the text in front of me.
Yeah, I need to do this since I'm up first anyway, so. Send. Give series in there. Send. Okay. Now I can't find the image anymore. Oh, there it is. Okay. Well, that's weird. Weird. Anyway. I think I'm good to go.
Okay. Let's begin with a minute or two of meditation then, just silence. I'll ring a bell and then I'll start my part of the presentation and then lead into you.
Okay.
So I took some liberties with this here at the opening. But the intention of our presentation is, let me go back. I mean, the title of what we're talking about today is Multidimensionality and Aperspectivity in Quantum and Field Poetics. And the intention of our presentation is to invite an experience of poetic receptivity and, if possible, creativity in the collective field of consciousness in the present moment. The structure of this will consist of three gestures. The first by Jeffrey Edwards on quantum poetics and the aperspectival in writing fiction and poetry, Cross Grains. The second by Heather Fester on incommunicable kingdoms of spirit, implications of multiplied dimensioned writing process in Gebser, Kreuter, and Manning. And the third by myself, whose title is To Be Determined, on the collapse of waves, intensifications, and singularities in the field, attuning to a cosmic poetics of the future. Each of these presentations will be about 20 minutes long. And then we'll have time at the end for about 20 minutes of open dialogue and response from the audience. And the invitation we would like to make is that you join us in this journey or this arc of language in three moments of experience. One of them is sensing the field. The second is holding the field. And the third is carrying the field. And what these mean will become more apparent as we go on, but they all have to do with a sense of our presence, our attention, our listening, our receptivity, and our allowing of a movement to occur in the flow and the play of language. So with that, I'm going to hand it to Jeffrey to get us started with his presentation, and then I'll come back after Heather.
Thank you. The way you can go isn't the real way. The name you can say isn't the real name. Heaven and earth begin in the unnamed. Names the mother of the 10,000 things. So the unwanting soul sees what's hidden, and the ever-wanting soul sees only what it wants. Two things, one origin, but different in name. Whose identity is mystery? Mystery of all mysteries. The door to the hidden. From the Tao Te Ching. Arranged by Le Guin, Ursula Le Guin. Wara, Waraki, 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 Waraki. Takami, Takamaye. Well-made stone blades, discarded flakes lie scattered. Wandama, Wandamayi, Waraki, 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 Kakami, Kakamayi, flaking the well-made stone blade, the well-made blade, discarded flakes lay scattered. From an Aboriginal song from the book Singing Saltwater Country by John Bradley with the Yanyuwa families. The magic of the original songs is that they are always about very down-to-earth practices, while at the same time carrying much larger loads. They are deeply quantum, involving repetition, onomatopoeia, rhymes, alliteration, and so forth. So I'd like a couple of numbers. So I want a number between 1 and 5. Can somebody suggest a number?
Ed says 4.
4. And a number between 1 and 11. Somebody?
John says 10.
10. Okay. Can you guys remember those numbers for me? Because I might forget them. But so quantum field poetry, a definition. The general idea is a text which can be viewed as activating a broad field of meaning and resonance, itself grounded in day-to-day experience and attending to both the text and its associated field. In field poetics, the text describes an underlying reality directly. There are several defining characteristics of the notion of field: interconnectedness, continuity, self-referentiality, time unfolding, non-hierarchicality, boundedness, generative of forces. For example, onomatopoeia expresses self-referentiality, while alliteration expresses interconnectedness and continuity. Regular metric forms may be viewed as fields with wave-like properties, and additional regularities such as end-of-line rhyming may be viewed as interference patterns where the repetitions result in enhanced semantic effects. In quantum field poetics, however, text is the result of applying principles, quantization principles, to an experiential field, intermediate between text and reality, leading to a mix of combined text and meaning effects. Some additional properties of quantum field poetics include the coupling of words and meaning within an uncertainty principle, virtual semantic clouds, propagating boundary effects, metastable states, repetitions, and triggers, meaning construction via inter-sentence exchanges, degeneracy of meaning, and thoughts and feelings as forces, a kind of bosonic mediation. Now I'm going to say the same thing again, but inside a poem, which is called quantum field poem. What is the field? When a smile loops back on itself, when it lies flat but alive with movement, when it abuts against its own limits, carried there by felines of force, and then leaves its subtle body as flotsam in the receding tide. What is the field? When I sit at my loom, the thread crosses itself, weft and warp intertwined, past and future come together in a surface that drapes around your shoulders, another kind of crossing. What is the field? When words shadow each other, dancing delightfully in digital declamations, when sentences rub against each other, cats upon an etherized table, wrapping their tails around fluid space like some oceanic clapotis. Then field and stream flick and jump within the current, or simply watch and dream as words and winning whys drop to the electric ground, preparing the way for the holy quantum. Let us play. Vibration tunneling its way from the numinous to the indescribable, an oscillation between wave and particle, idea and event, soul and body, verb and noun. It's not so much a matter of probability as it is a quest for the liminal, the interstices between reality and expectation. It's some kind of dream space, a vast atrium where spirit rubs shoulders with time. The bound and the boundless caught inside our private animal paradoxes. The quantum shudders within its own ambiguity, whether particles or words, clusters gather us within their potent velocities. Energy or meaning, two equivalences, both partners with crime, with time. Heisenberg pairings, without a doubt, each takes root in the other and resounds. While the field prepares for ruptures, break lines, cracks, these things radiate across an ocean of verbs, carrying awareness forward, abrupt changes in direction, echoes and half homonyms, these also syncopate across multiple dimensions and resound. A perspectival in the immediacy of life interleaved with God stuff. Integral in the beyond of 10,000 forms, all meaning the same. Degeneracy, not in the sense of vagrancy or the delinquent, although these are no strangers to the rejection of structure, but rather a collapse of the many dimensions that shape our inner lives. Just as this poetic field is pulled and pushed by your thoughts and states, not to mention emotions, so all fields are molded by such bosonic mediators. Art is nothing else but a trace of hidden forces acting in the pastures of someone else's garden. Then a little musical interlude that I don't have. Excerpt from Intimus Cordis, chapter 14, Rayakana. Rakana Namina speaks. Here we catch the Rayakana, the song which begins in the sea beyond Lutriwita, swims upwards towards Earth orbit, and then outwards in a vast curve and comes curving towards ascent. It is the song of the whale become Jonah, a story of transformation from the ancient to the novel. The whale become Jonah is born in the seas of old Earth at the bottom of the well, but comes forth to soar into the sky, changing as he goes. A deep humming sound fills the space, the pitch rising and falling, and then Rakana Mina begins the song while the others tonally support her. From the sea's depths comes the hunting whale, soaring into the air. The Rayakana names this country Milethina Wurankili, sky country, and her kin. Kanaplila, big whale dances as he comes, the song lifting before him across the space of stars. Narayangina in Wurangankili, he swims in the sky across the star country. Wurankili Mapali Mapatruli, the many sky fires sing his country. Liina Milithaina Nanya, big whale comes. Nura Mulaka in Milithina Mapali Patruli, he hunts in many fire country. This is the way the song begins, laying out the route taken by the whale god in his path across the stars from Lutriwita on old Earth to Ascent Station. The song goes on for hours, filled with its rhythmic tides moving to and fro as it comes between the language of the Lutriwitans and our modern dialects, constantly thrown forward and receding backwards. The song is hypnotic, melodic, ritualistic, and gives shape to this first small step of our journey in language that is simple and yet deeply stirring. Another musical interlude still to be picked. Excerpt from Third Testament, chapter 9, Traversal. Later, Ionian wandered away from the compound. There was, as she expected, a wat, or temple, a short distance closer to the town center. This was not as ornate as others she had seen, but was just as carefully maintained. It was constructed from a combination of bamboo and a harder wood, possibly banana. She stepped inside, and instantly, to her surprise, experienced a measure of the wonder she had felt during their ferry ride, the result of her communion with the changing conditions of the ocean waters. This was a place of humility more than exaltation, and it calmed her. There was a noise behind her. She turned, and one of the monkeys was clambering onto a raised dais. Monkeys, princes of playful royalty, if the old traditions were to be believed. Indeed, Hanuman in Hindu tradition was a god, but this was a Buddhist place, and the animal was rather well behaved. It could make an infernal racket if it wanted to, but right at this moment it was sitting quietly, running its tiny hands through the fur around its shoulders. But it did remind Ionian that quiet grooming, combined with a recognition of the incongruousness of life, were as much an experience of the Buddha as was an attitude of contemplation. She was entirely too serious in her devotions, she decided, and walked back out onto the street. She continued up the street toward the town center, dominated by a central spire. This was another Wat, larger and more important than the one Ionian had visited earlier. More a full-fledged school and residence, and much more embellished inside. Her animal coterie moved inside along with her. Any thoughts she might have had to hinder them were instantly invalidated. There was nothing she could really do. Besides, Buddhists respected animals completely, even more than did Hindus. Ionian felt the Buddhist had the right of it. Animals were every bit as important as humans. In some ways, they were more important. They incarnated our relationship to the wider world, the world beyond the human sphere. To revere animals meant to accept our place in the universe as one among many, with no greater or lesser rights than animals themselves. What Ionian valued about the Hindu religions he had practiced all her life was the way you sought to promote harmony between all things. Animals were part of this harmony, although that didn't mean you preserved their lives above others. True, eating animal flesh was no longer a part of human traditions and had been largely abandoned on most worlds. But Buddhists sought something different, not harmony, but rather nirvana, the process of letting go. Although there was a relationship between the two goals, they were nonetheless distinct. Ionian appreciated both goals, but it wasn't clear how you could respect both simultaneously. Weren't there situations where seeking to let go might not involve harmony necessarily, or vice versa, situations where harmony meant hanging on rather than letting go? Letting go of one's seriousness, of one's need for harmony, of one's committed practice within Hinduism, of one's traditionalism, but maybe also of one's radicalism, one's need to be right, one's sense of devotion, letting go of one's need to let go, letting go of all this thinking. She shook her head and went back down the street toward the compound. Dark had fallen. There were a few lights around, some fugues casting their dappled lights on the individual particles moved around, as well as more traditional lanterns with their warm yellow pools. The thing about the daily practices Ionian had carried out her life was this. They were largely unconscious, not automatic. She understood them with a sense of mindfulness, of presence. In fact, they traced out a kind of joy, a luminosity in her day-to-day life, an access to the numinous that never entirely went away, no matter what mood swings life brought. And yet Ionian sensed that the practice of Buddhism was different. You were present for a kind of absence. It did not involve unconscious rituals in the same way, but rather a kind of intentionality. Of course, there were a practice designed to remind you of the stance you needed to adopt, but the practices weren't the source of joy in the same way they were for Hindu prayers. In fact, joy wasn't even the desired issue, the undesired issue, the lack of desired issue. And at this point in her life, at this particular moment, she understood the difference. Indeed, she embraced it. The rest was secondary. The buildings, the images, the statues, the movements, the contemplation, none of it was ultimately important. The universe had turned itself inside out, and Ionian found herself awed by the change she had witnessed. So to finish up, from the Tao Te Ching to the Aboriginal song, to the introduction to quantum field poetics, to the excerpt from Intimus Cordis about song lines among the stars, to the Third Testament excerpt that deals with the relationship between Hinduism, Buddhism, and integral. These are different grains that speak across each other and yet summon a common thread. Let us finish with an invocation for magic, text from the system of time. So we said the number was 4. So 4 times 12 is 48. And the number was 10, so it's 58. So this is an oracle that I've been writing for the saga of science fiction stories. So I said it was 50. 50 is the verses for the second of Edo. Is that right? 50? 48? No, 58. 58 is the court of Edo. Within the tents, we dream of our multiple personas. Each body echoes yearnings. Awake, all is forgotten. Halfway into the world, the vision beckons, but how I act is driven by the unseen. Thank you. Oh, shit.
I'm working on sharing my screen. Give me just a second.
Okay. I thought I lost you guys.
Thank you, Jeffrey. That was beautiful.
Okay, can everyone
see? How was I
see?
On time for that? Is it okay?
Yeah, you were right about 20, maybe a couple minutes under. Okay, so now I have the sharing things on top of it. There we go. Can everyone see my screen okay?
No, I can't. Hang on.
Okay.
It's probably something I'm doing wrong.
Okay, so I'll read the... I'll start off reading the quote at the bottom of the presentation screen. This comes from a foreword to Clarice Lispector's Agua Viva. And the word Agua Viva, the title of her book, means, in Portuguese, it means the jellyfish, which you see in the background, and the wellspring. And she said, Michael Sefor, whom she's quoting, says, "There must be a kind of painting totally free of the dependence on a figure or object, which, like music, illustrates nothing, tells no story, and launches no myth. Such painting would simply evoke the incommunicable kingdoms of spirit, where dream becomes thought, where line becomes existence." So I started my preparations for this presentation thinking about dimension and perspective, specifically as Gebser talks about them. Gebser recognizes that we have both dimension and perspective to describe the relationship between individual structures and space and time. And he says that this is consistent as we move from archaic to magic to mythic to mental to integral. The relationship between the structure and a shifting sense of space and time remains consistent. With dimension, we have, with every new structure of consciousness, we have the appearance of a new dimension. And with perspective, we have an aspect of space and time relation, which stands out in a perspectivally rigidified world. Gebser spends a lot of time describing how with the mental structure of consciousness, we have a rigidification that comes from a perspectival world where space and time are confines or limitations. We can only be aware of one sector of reality at a time through perspective. So he looks at this through artists and poets. And he says that perspective served yet another function that came about at the same time as painters were capturing landscapes and showing perspective in their work, is that man gained an awareness of the visibility of himself, his own visibility. So this chart, I don't know if the words are fully visible here, maps the relationship between space and time with the structures. So when we move from mental, three-dimensional, which is represented by the triangle, into the integral, the four-dimensional, it's represented by the sphere. And the emphasis moves from a duality or an opposition, a paradox, into diaphaneity, or the, all of this is a way of expressing the aperspectival. I start this discussion of the fourth dimension with a quote that it was rumored that some particularly ardent adherents of the cubes had even gone mad. And this comes from an article by John Crabb, I believe is his name. And the title of the article is Notes on the Fourth Dimension. And it really captures the history of the fourth dimension across movements, including mystical schools of thought that were influenced by fourth dimensional work, art schools like Cubism and Surrealism, which really took on the project of it, some more successfully than others. Gebser would say that Picasso actually found an answer in his work with the dimensions, whereas the cubists failed to do so. Gebser says the four-dimensionality of the integral structure represents ultimately an integration of the dimensions. It results in space and time free, a space and time free aperspectival world where freed consciousness has at its disposal all latent as well as actual forms of space and time without having either to deny them or be fully subject to them. And with this, something that's interesting, as we move into perspective, the relationship to the whole is lessened or dimmed. Man is a participant in the whole, but the origin is latent and therefore still present. So dimensionality up to our aperspectivity seems to be split off from the whole. I'm not sure about the placement of this slide, but I'll just share from this quote by Clarice Lispector to return to that initial image of agua viva. This is from her writing now. She says, "Let me tell you, I am trying to seize the fourth dimension of this instant now, so fleeting that it's already gone because it's already become a new instant now that's also already gone. Everything has an instant in which it is. I want to grab hold of the is of the thing. These instants passing through the air I breathe. In fireworks, they explode silently in space. I want to possess the atoms of time. During love, the impersonal jewel of the moment shines in the air. Only in time itself is there room enough for me. All of me is writing to you, and I feel the taste of being and the taste of you is as abstract as the instant. So hear me with your whole body. Now I feel the need for words, and what I am writing is new to me, because until now, my true word has never been touched. The word is my fourth dimension. Some considerations of the mental structure, which we see prominent around us in the world, giving rise to this integral structure in terms of art and perspective. The mental structure recognizes subject and object. There's a dualism inherent in that. The mental looks through space and grasps it rationally. This is part of what allows the development of a personal or ego consciousness. The mental has similar intensities to consciousness, but these are material, possibly measurable in their arrangement. The sign, the triangle, is like what Leonardo da Vinci described as the triangle of perspective, with either the base seated at the eyes looking out towards the horizon, so the two lines from the eyes looking toward the horizon to form the triangle, or the horizon being the base of the triangle coming towards the eyes. And another way to think of that triangle is with Hegel's formulation of dialectical thought, where we have thesis and antithesis paired together and they form a new synthesis, and that's a triangle. Whereas with the shift away from that paradoxical thinking, we have aperspectivity or the post-dialectical. And it requires new ways of describing measurement. One term that Gebser uses is amensionality instead of dimensionality. So he says, the tenor of the magic structure is definitely one of the psyche realized in imagery, and that of the mythical structure is one of the psyche, the tenor of the mental structure is one of a spatial world realized in thought. The I and an egocentric world are solidified in the mental structure, but maybe origin shines through as in romance, we have vestiges of the earlier structures like the romantic writers. And here we have this representation of space using the third dimension in Leonardo's work. Gebser was fond of Picasso. His work showed something about the shift into the integral aperspectival. He says it renders the whole visible, where space and body become transparent, much like the body of the jellyfish in the background as well. With aperspectival drawing, time is no longer spatialized, but integrated and concretized as the fourth dimension. This renders the whole visible to sight. Time, because time is expressed as in an intensified and valid form as the present, the pure present. What at first glance appears to be distorted or dislocated in the eyes of the sailor here and the woman, those are actually complementary overlapping or temporal factors and spatial sectors, audaciously rendered simultaneously and conspatially on the pictorial surface. Only where time emerges as pure present and is no longer divided into its three phases of past, present, and future is it concrete. To the extent that Picasso from the outset reached out beyond the present, incorporating the future into the present of his work, he was able to presentiate or make present the past. And part of this process, bringing awareness to the present, everything that was relegated to the dormancy of forgetfulness, as well as everything latent as something yet to come. I'm looking for my phone here. Here we go. Okay. So a couple more Picasso drawings. And I like this second version because of the way that we see the different representations here in sculpture and then the presentation in Guernica, Picasso's Guernica painting. Multiple dimensions and times at once. I'm gonna skip over Suzanne Cook-Greuter's perspectives. I'll say just a brief word about it. She situates her model of development based on perspectives we take. And these figures from her nine levels of increasing embrace document represent this increase in perspective taking. So we move from a fourth person perspective to an expanded fourth person perspective in the central image, the image in the center, and then beyond that to a fifth person and then an nth person perspective in this last image here. So with this, we have a move from more conventional to post-conventional forms of thinking and being aware of the world and making meaning, perceiving. So with the more conventional structures prior to this first image here, there's very little questioning of the beliefs we hold, where we come from, how we got those beliefs. With the shift to fourth person perspective, I will share the one of her definitions here. She says that it's a major watershed because it's the move from conventional to post-conventional meaning making. It allows individuals to stand outside the system they grew up in and observe themselves and their cultural surround from a new altitude. From there, one gets a better view of the whole valley or plain below. One can look at the familiar through a new lens and query many of its tacit assumptions, values, and beliefs. So this is an important shift. And then she has identified four stages beyond that, including one that we think of in the Kinwilber world as the integral. The emergence of perspective, however, where I want to focus most of my attention here is the role it plays in lyric poetry. And Gebser has a way of describing this as well. Because we have with this shift into the third dimension and the ability to take perspective with the mental rational, we have the consolidation of ego consciousness. The poets increasingly were able to use I to express or sing their personal sorrows and joys. And in poetry then we see that the content of the poem is no longer restricted to the evocation of collectively held preconscious contents. It is henceforth accompanied by the partially conscious or partly conscious statement of moods and experiences that are echoed not only in feeling but in the rational understanding of the listener or reader. And this creates the lyric poem. There's a detachment from memory that is the initial step towards the supersession of time. The turn away from memory is the turn toward freedom. And specifically here, as we move into this integral type of poetry, we have that it resists facile inspiration from the muses, a growing above and beyond the mental ego to a freedom from the ego. And more of a sense of inspiration as wellspring, like with the, again, with the agua viva image. The third thinker I wanted to dive into, I have less to work with in terms of her phrase writing with, but it's an interesting question that I continue to hold, how she means the phrase writing with. Erin Manning, in her book, The Minor Gesture, says that in the review process, she had the luck of encountering thinking at the limit. She considers this an affirmative gesture, an affirmation without credit. The reviewers took time to think with the text in a gesture of writing with, returning the minor gesture to her with the richness of an engagement that was capable of opening her thinking beyond where she thought it could go. How this helped her see how thinking does its work in the writing. She says, what struck me in reading these reviews, can these still be called reviews, was how fragile this gesture of writing with made me feel. The fragility, I think, has to do with writing pushed to a limit where it is truly in contact with the tremulousness of thinking in the act. Bringing thought into contact with its limit this way is a minor gesture. So I'm not quite ready to talk about quantum field poetics. And I'm also new to Prezi. And I don't intend to read quite so many quotes in the final presentation, but this is sort of the stage where I'm at. I will read a few of T.S. Eliot's Meditations on Time from the Four Quartets, however, as we go. Here are a few. In my beginning is my end. To be restored, our sickness must grow worse. Footfalls echo in the memory, down the passage which we did not take. towards the door we never opened into the rose garden. "Go, go, go," said the bird. "Humankind cannot bear very much reality. Time past and time future. What might have been and what has been point to one end, which is always present. For the pattern is new in every moment, and every moment is a new and shocking valuation of all we have seen. We are only undeceived of that which deceiving could no longer harm." So I want to end this presentation actually with three questions that I'm holding as a writer. In the context of aperspectival writing and poetic fields, do we have a sense of agency? Eliot says, "To apprehend the point of intersection of the timeless with time is an occupation for the saint." Gebser offers us the notion of an emergence of order with the terms like systasis and synairesis, terms which I understood better after reading Ed Mahood's overview. But I want to capture something from that and maybe also from Jeffrey's work on poetic fields here in this, in the future of that slide. It's latent, hopefully, in the slide itself. Is quantum field poetics necessarily nonlinear or alinear? That's another question I'm holding as a writer. And what does it mean to write alinearly versus nonlinearly? The Wilbur crowd, and they're thinking on integral, has sort of a re-aggrandizement of narratives and wholes. Things look very much like hierarchies and orders, a return, not a naive return, but a reconstruction. So I'm curious to feel into what an alinear type of writing might be. "While time is withdrawn, consider the future and the past with an equal mind," Eliot says. "Time as linear involves spatialization. In a certain sense, nonlinear time is a fragmentation of that spatialized time. So it's maybe not a resolution, but a fragmentation. Time represents an aspect of the element of intensity which constitutes the world," Gebser says, which is different from extensive phenomena that, you know, the exhale that we perceive from the mental rational. "Time as intensity is a dominant theme of the new mutation. The new strength of spirit with which we have to do here is achronic. It cannot be temporalized. It's time free, and this means it's also space free. And time is not to be understood as measurable time or duration, but as quality and intensity." And then finally, my final question here is, what is the connection between relational and poetic field on the one hand and Manning's writing width on the other? "To arrive where you are, to get from where you are not, you must go by a way wherein there is no ecstasy. In order to arrive at what you do not know, you must go by a way which is the way of ignorance." And end with a quote from Jeffrey and Clarisse Tremblay on, they say here, "This profoundly modern observation that perceived reality and the perception process are characteristic of the artistic field was made parallel to the quantum mechanics revolution in physics, which came to parallel conclusion. Measurability of this common external reality was thrown into question such that the space of intimacy and the space of the physical universe could be postulated to be one and the same." So those are some of my initial explorations into these interrelated topics. And I'm grateful for the chance to practice, but I also know that I have more composing to do to provide some explanation between, or to make more of this my own way of speaking. So, but thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Heather. That was wonderful.
I clocked you at 19 minutes, so we're...
I feel desire to use bells in our presentation. Bells at the beginning, bells in the middle, bells at the end. I don't quite have the right bells. I have this little tinkly bell here. It doesn't really carry, it doesn't really resonate. I have my meditation bell, which is a bit too, I don't know, meditative. I'm just going to dive into what I have. I prepared some remarks, and I'm going to also share a poem. So the title of this talk, To Be Determined, is not the title of this talk. When Jeffrey and Heather invited me to join them in the exploration of co-creation in quantum field poetic space, my mind traveled to the concept of indeterminacy, which I understood in a fuzzy way to have something to do with the way the future state of a system at the quantum level can't be predicted by what is currently known about it. There is a technical definition, too, something about the relationship between measurement and observation, and the way that information which results from the act of observation will spread out over a range of probabilities rather than end in specific outcomes that could be determined in advance and thus repeated precisely. And this seemed to me to be to map or be a metaphor for the way that poetry could work, or so I thought. The quote, wave function collapse could correspond to the way poetic words fall into place out of the realm of mental chaos and inchoate possibility. Jeffrey had elaborated on these themes in his work on quantum poetics, and Heather had come into relationship with this field through her own work as a poet and educator. They met on the Infinite Conversations Forum in one of our reading groups. I think it was the group that Jeffrey initiated for Aaron Manning's book, The Minor Gesture. And we began reading The Minor Gesture as another semi-overlapping group was reading Peter Sloterdijk's Spheres trilogy, particularly the second volume on globes. And one of the connections between those two readings is that in Spheres, Sloterdijk was exploring a shape or a form that Gebser identifies, as Heather pointed out, with the integral and the a perspectival. In the intermediate months, we had gone from these groups into a writing group in the quote-unquote writer's underground zone of the Metapsychosis Project, a series of monthly meetings which took the form of revelations, during which we shared work in progress, listened deeply, and gave feedback, and have been reflecting upon our process as writers. In the same overall space over the past few months, we've had a group reading the full text of Sri Aurobindo's The Life Divine. And in a weekly series of mostly open frame dialogues called Cosmos Cafe, another semi-overlapping and variable group has been discussing topics in cosmology, consciousness, literature, philosophy, technology, current events, and whatever else comes up. We did two sessions on Jennifer Gidley's essay from the Integral Review Journal, The Evolution of Consciousness as a Planetary Imperative, an Integration of Integral Views, where she compares and contrasts the overall philosophical projects of Jean Gebser, Rudolf Steiner, and Wilber. And we covered on Jean Gebser's essay, The Grammatical Mirror, which prompted me to write an experimental poetic piece called Grammatical Monster, which I recorded as an audio piece with music and published as a, quote, microdose on Metapsychosis. And we've done various sessions on cosmology and time, including discussions of Michael Garfield's podcast, Future Fossils, and Carrie Welch on Fractal Time, who I think is going to be present, by the way. I think Carrie's, I'm looking forward to her presentation. Amongst a variety of other topics, we've also read fiction by Ursula K. Le Guin, Bahia Nakhchivani, Gao Jing Zhang, and Octavia Butler. All this is to say that this moment in time, this indeterminate concretion, has a history. And what I've named barely touches the surface of the fields that all of us, that we all carry with us, and that we co-constitute. And what the quality, and what is the quality, what quality of these underlying fields could give, I didn't write the sentence correctly, but something about the quality of these underlying fields giving rise to particular creative and poetic expressions. The first big collective intellectual project we hosted on Infinite Conversations was the Winter of Origins reading of The Ever-Present Origin, in 2016, which Jeremy Johnson and I orchestrated. My own personal background, the reason I moved to Colorado in 2003 was as a student of Ken Wilber. From 2003 to 2007, I was employed by Wilber's Integral Institute. I now co-authored a book with Wilber, Terry Patton, and Adam Leonard called Integral Life Practice. My path since 2007, however, has led me to search for the deeper roots of integral consciousness and thought, and especially a deeper relationship with the spiritual creativity that had attracted and impelled me in the first place. That's what brings me to this event. Jeffrey and Heather had begun working on the quantum field concept before I got involved, and though I had listened to and read some of their exploratory exchanges, I was more of a bystander at first. But I felt resonant with their musings because almost everything I've been trying to do through Infinite Conversations, Metapsychosis, Cosmos, and my poetic writing has related to creating fields and field effects through dialogue and conversation, editing, curation, publishing, and organizing readers and reading and writing groups in the Readers Underground and Writers Underground. Indeed, it seemed I might be able to discern a kind of cosmic poetics or method in the madness of these intersecting projects, which I think has something to do with reshaping space and time, or our experiences of space and time. Still, I had no idea what I wanted to present on, what might want to fulfill itself through me intellectually. In the reality of time, it was a last minute request, with a proposal deadline coming up in just a few days. So I suggested in all seriousness that my contribution would be TBD. And I made something up very quickly for the description of my talk. TBD. That sounds like a spiritually transmitted disease. I apologize. I may be contagious. For the record, TBD is not the compound in medicinal cannabis that gets you high. TBD means let's see what happens. Let's see what comes up. What wants to happen? What wants to emerge? The beauty of the invitation was that it would not just be through me that the poetry of this moment would happen, if it happened, but through us, Jeffrey, Heather, and I, and through all of us who would be and are present, who would be and are listening, sensing, feeling, knowing, and not knowing, not really knowing what's going to happen next. Which is where my offering here finds its theme and focus. It's where time comes into the question, the something happening next. The title of this talk, which is not its title, to be determined, relates to Gebser's thoughts on the question of time. I say the question of time because for me, it's a question, a radically open question. What is time? And I've been obsessed with this question since, well, even before I could tell you, without asking the question first, what is time? But it was before I had learned about integral theory or the integral structure of consciousness. The question of time itself had a mystery and allure. It was my muse. I know there has been a lot of sophisticated thinking done on time. When I was a younger man, I went to Heidegger for answers and learned that time has something to do with being in the world, being towards death, being with others. Time is ultimately about the fact that we care. And so we project ourselves into the future out of our state of being thrown into existence from the past. At the quantum level of reality, I've read, it's possible that time doesn't exist or doesn't make sense, is irrelevant ultimately, and doesn't compute. Time stops working. I'm thinking of Carlo Rovelli's, by the way, here. A pesky physicist might proclaim they have no need of that hypothesis. We discussed this in a bit in a conversation called Rethinking Time, touching on the physicist Carlo Rovelli's work, and contrasted with alternate ways of knowing that involve psychic, dreaming, and contemplative practices and modes of experiencing time. It's a good thing, in my opinion, that at some level time stops working for all of us who want or would wish for a better relationship with time. All work and no play, after all, makes for a dull metaphysical category. Time has been working tirelessly, busting its ass since, well, forever, I suppose. So to the question, what is time? We might well conjecture, well, if time is superseded at the quantum level and through the integral manifestation, and if we so desire at the poetic level as well, then what might time do, we might ask, with its free time? What can time do? What might it let us do? What is time good for anyway? We know we can organize our lives and measure durations of events with clocks, but clocks measure time. They're not time. What could we do with time itself? How could we relate to time creatively, I wondered. Could we play with time? Make love with it? Could time be a partner in a dialogue or a dance? What does time desire if it wants of anything? Who is time? As I dug back into Gebser's text, I honed in on two themes which I would like to bring into this field. The first comes through Gebser's thoughts on the nature of creativity, and the second on the nature of poetry, and what he calls a history of the dateless. So far, I've been talking about things that have happened in time. Here's a little more before I shift. I may not include this next part, but I'm just going to go with it. Here's a little more before I shift into another, perhaps another dimension, perhaps the fourth dimension. I understand this history because the scientific mind of the Western Enlightenment had gotten used to visualizing the world in terms of three-dimensional, a three-dimensional, aka Cartesian grid. I should have a picture of a grid here, where objects existed and moved around in such ways that, hypothetically at least, they could be located at any point in space at any time. Theoretically, under the right conditions, anything could be measured and thus determined by the objective observer. The world could be known exactly and precisely with, quote, clear and distinct concepts, as Descartes put it. This was the mental rational worldview and world construction, which Gebser saw in crisis. He had studied the developments in quantum mechanics and saw in the new scientific verition of the limits of measurement, the limits of perspective, an indication of a new structure of consciousness he called the aperspectival, or integral, being born. For Gebser, the quantum concepts and the new poetics were both equally manifestations of the eruption of time into consciousness, I-R-R-U-P-T-I-O-N. I might put that up. The who of time is the observer in the field equations of physics. The act of observation is the event through which something changes in reality. Possibility becomes actual. What was to be determined is concretized. In section 3 of chapter 2 of part 2 of The Ever-Present Origin, Gebser presents his observations on the new form of statement, quote, referring to the poetry of the new mutation. This sentence is mangled. He writes, and I would like to have a slide for this. I have a slide for some of the slides for the other quotes, but I didn't make one for this one, I don't think. So long as, let me check, do I have it? No. Sorry. Yeah. So long as we think that we can master such intensities as time by forcing them into a system, the intensities will simply burst such systems apart, which is what happened to the Cartesian grid, which science has long abandoned, and poetry never really warmed up to begin with. It remains in our consciousness, it seems, as the basic background assumption of what reality is or seems to be. Gebser goes on. Our new situation requires new means of description and statement. The new components which have erupted into our reality demand new concepts. But when we begin to sense the truly new, it is no longer new. It has already occurred. End quote. And so I thought, going with the new concepts which Jeffrey and Heather were bringing forward, and given that I only had a few days to come up with something before the registration deadline, I decided to defer my act of observation, my determination of what I would even be talking about, to the moment itself when the field between us, our new consciousness, was actually present, rather than merely being a projection of my imagination into a future time, in abstract space. Gebser regarded it as an urgent necessity that we clear space for the new, for the eruptions to come and which are already happening. He defines time not as past, present, and future in spatial visualization, in a spatial visualization or virtualization, but as quality and intensity. Quality and intensity. Time is how a spiritual reality comes into the world. But it is not something in the future or the past. It is now. But now is not just what we think it is, what we might observe or measure. What is time? What is a quality? What is an intensity? These are the questions that interest me as a poet. What is the new form of statement now? After all, it's been 60-odd years since Gebser's writings and more since the breakthroughs in quantum logics. In calendar time, we've been through the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, the noughts, and here we are in the 20-teens. We've been through cultural revolutions, technological transformations, wars and revelations, lives and deaths. Is origin any more or less present now? What have we learned since then? What's possible now? What remains to be determined? What is opening up in this moment? I don't know how long I've been going. I have a couple of more.
You've got 18 minutes. So
18 minutes?
2 minutes.
Darn. All right. Well, then that's where I will have to transition. Either cut down with previous or transition into my poem. I had a couple of choice quotes by Gebser to share. One about creativity as being essentially about making origin present and the radical discontinuity of that act. The other about poetry as a writing of history, but not the history of dates, a history of the dateless. And I think it's going to be important that I get to this concept, because the piece I'm going to read is, I think, an example of a history of the dateless. And it's a piece that I wrote before I'd read Gebser, before I had even read Wilbur, become enamored and interested in integral theory. And I think that it was a way, in a way, a manifestation for me, an eruption of time into my own consciousness, which predated the kind of work and explorations that I would be getting into through my integral explorations and the work that we've been doing in the forum and in our shared fields. So I'm going to present this poem, which as something that I recognized through this process with Jeffrey and Heather, as an offering of a poetic statement manifesting origin and writing a history of the dateless. And the title of the poem, which you'll recognize from my handle on the forum, is Mad Rush. I wrote this poem to give it a date in 2002, when I was living in Brooklyn, New York, with my friend Mark Binet, who nobody would know, but except John and Heather. So imagine I had a much nicer bell. This is going to sound so lame with this little tinkly bell, but I'm going to try it. And this poem, I will go a little bit over, but it should be like about 5 minutes, and then we can open it up. Mad Rush. What is time? A river of broken clocks, or a highway strewn with angels? A spiral in the cosmic void, or is it the fear of love? What does one do if one never dies? Smiling, though we're kisses on glass, sand, the imaginary river, the slow city wants to be touched inside. Time is a hand reaching. A shining instant on a butterfly's wing of chaos. It glides through you. It alights on the altar of your palm. Waster of peoples. In this city, there is only mind. Subtle spheres illuminate the streets like droplets of the moon. The corpse was never yours. Little bell rings, ting, ting, ting. Oh, beloved little bell goes ting, ting, ting. Oh, I need a better bell. Into the open arms, straight into the open, loving arms of death. The welcomer is amused and sad, but he understands. You took me down this morning to bathe in a flowing jewel, wearing rainbows and wild laughter, we splashed up our reflections in the waves. What is time? Thunderbolt, wasted wheel, drag of disintegrating days, smashed jar that held tomorrow's ashes, a child's questioning eyes. Ancient grace. Let this surrendered body be your ecstatic body. Open our breast to the song. Let us go where the sky and mountains go, when you bid them, without words, deep into the chasm of your bosom. Okay, with that, I'll open it up.
So I had one more thing I needed to say that I'd forgotten to do. So because it was the music I did was Creative Commons, I need to identify and credit the musicians. So Dark Red Earth by Cohen was the first one. Peace by Roca Vaco was the second one. And River by Jerris was the third one.
Yeah, and I'll have to give credits for the images and so forth. Details. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening through that.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much. Are we open? Is this an open frame? Or
So we're going to open it up to whatever wants to arise. We'll let the audience at this point respond to us, and if it,
Great. So I'm pretending I'm an audience member who knows all of you very well, which is true. On some level, I think I know all of you very well, and that we're all in this together. We're all in the same boat. This very fascinating developments, I think, are happening in the field. And I just had I had some questions and some gut feel kind of responses. But I just wanted to say that I love the way Jeffrey is this his basso voice, very grounded and channeling a lot of earth. Yet there's a lot of space as well. And I like the hunting whale, the very Melville kind of images coming through, and the song lines where you're looking at the skyscape and the stars. The cat's etherized upon a table. Did I get that right?
Yes.
Yes, that's very interesting.
I wanted to quote D.S. Eliot, but I slipped that in instead.
Yeah, I like the cats. That's a lot of fun. 'Cause he also wrote a big poem on cats, didn't he?
Well, it's taken from Prufrock, but it's mixed up from Prufrock. Right?
Well, I enjoyed that illusion. And have each of you had a different energy, but I felt that you were all drawing upon, you were all resonating together from the field, a shared field. I thought that Heather was bringing us more into psychology and with Cook Greuter and developmental psychology and large questions about the agent and the first person. And I thought she did a really good job, or you did a very good job of looking at the weave of these different kind of integral-ish perspectives, and how this has affected the discipline of poetry, especially. I thought you did mention something that I thought was echoed a bit in Marco's presentation that I wanted to invite maybe a look at. You talked about Wilbur and his sort of Hegelian, that Hegelian synthesis and that the post-dialectical and I think there was a movement towards the meta-narrative, and I felt you were sort of exploring an alternative to that, and I thought that was interesting, and I wanted to sort of develop that a little bit more. Also, Michael, I thought the history of transformation, I thought was of great use to all of us, since many of us have been participating with you in trying to put some flesh on this, on all of these theories. And I thought that was particularly compelling overview. And also, I think you were, And I loved your poem. I think it was the third stanza. It glides right through you. And something about like the butterfly on the altar of your palm. I think this was a little bit of, can I just make a suggestion? This isn't necessarily for you particularly, but if anyone finds this useful, it's an old actor technique, actually. You can do this right before you go to bed. But if you put one hand here, whichever is your, you know, we have a left hand, right hand. We also have a left ear and a right ear, but it's not always the best ear. But you just cup it here and then cup this so that you can hear your speech. And you can sort of whisper the lines of the whatever you're reciting. And it can kind of creates a loop between the auditory and the speech centers. And it can start vibrating the vagal nerve, that social engagement system. Something to do almost in a contemplative kind of way. It's just so you can just play with the words in a very intimate kind of way. Because I think that you want to get that intimate feeling in your own psychosomatic interplay so that when you are in front of your audience, you've maintained that contact to that somatic intelligence, and which, you know, brings you into the field effect. So I just would invite you all, if you want to consider playing around with that, especially at night when you go to bed, lying on your pillow. Yeah. I find it really helps the language go much more deeper, which it facilitates performance. Anyway, those are some of the things that I noted, but I wanted to, I just have an open question. What I wanted more of, and this may not be appropriate at all for this presentation. I wanted to, and this has a little bit to do with my own experience, or a lot to do with my own experience with the Wilbur and that version of Integral, a very noble tradition in many ways. But I think that there has been some critique of that by some of us here. And as we've looked at Gidley, and you've traced this history, Marco, in your presentation pretty well. And I think Ed was here for a lot of that inquiry as well. So I think the Gidley was looking at the difference between Wilbur, who is really a man of science, but in many ways, I think a sort of aesthetically challenged. That's sort of not his interest. But I think that Steiner and Gebser, whom Gidley focused on in that paper, but she also referenced Aurobindo. These are poets, and they are very interested, I think, in voice and poetry and language. That's front and center in their interests, and I believe it comes out in their theory making too. So I think that's a very important difference, that Wilbur, with his, you know, scientific, his ability to handle all that, with what I think Aurobindo and Gebser and Steiner were focusing on. And I think Gidley brings this out in her paper, and I think that's sort of in the background of especially Heather and Marco's remarks. But I think that I would like to bring that a little bit foreground, because I think it'd be really healthy for the community to look at this juxtaposition. There may be many integralisms. And as we, I think Cook Reuter, I think you looked at her developmental scheme, and she's looking at the different stages within vision logic, which I think, I don't know, Wilbur may have coined that term. But I think there's a difference between, you guys can correct me if I'm off the wall here, but I think there's a movement about the higher octave, that integral, the aperspectival that Gebser's referring to, which is actually just sort of holding the previous structures. Whereas I think Wilbur, I think Gidley brings this out, Wilbur is actually proposing that there, and maybe Cook Order as well, is there are other structures beyond that they're tracking. So I think those are two different kinds of projects. And both of them may have their uses, and they may also not necessarily, I think there may be cracks and fissures as well that could be usefully looked at. So I hope some of that made sense, and was, I hope, very useful for you in making this presentation, what I believe will be a great success. So thank you very much. I learned a lot.
Thank you, Johnny, for your comments. I'm thinking here of Chris Dierkes gave a paper at Integral Theory Conference in 2015 that ultimately culminated in Gebster and traced Wilbur's use of the term vision image and then vision logic through Wilbur 1-6, I think it was. Anyway, and he there's a significant difference there that vision image is kind of like what the Tantrikas use with their transmission of the it's a more of a almost like an imaginal world you can walk through, whereas the vision logic shifts out of the symbolic. So that's where he leaves Centaur behind. So that paper in and of itself, I can send that or post that, might be of interest to you. And Dierkes talks a lot in that paper about how he wishes Wilbur had maintained the importance of Centaur, that blended image of the man and the horse and the body-mind integration that happens at that stage being such an important foundation that a lot of the more cognitive integralists leave behind. It's also, I would say, perhaps more of an artistic integration. Some of the things we've talked about, maybe.
Definitely. I think that the interplay between the perceptual and the affective and the cognitive is very crucial for us to function cognitively and to create new concepts. And I felt my experience was the affective and the perceptual were basically left out, and a sort of a third person was privileged. So for me, I was fine with the term vision logic, but where's the vision? I just hear a lot of logic. That was my complaint. And of course I got told to shut up and sit at the back of the room, pick a number and be quiet. But I probably did not articulate my grievances particularly well either. But I do think that's a difference and an important difference. And I think maybe why we're doing something different here as we are more interested in the arts and how do we express this sense of agency, and what that agency could possibly be with the history of transformation that we've inherited, but we've also in some ways being burdened by.
So. Some great comments there, Johnny, which I'll certainly go back to listen to again. I had a quick question just about the presentation format. So both Heather and Marco use slides with their quotes and text on the slides, and I didn't. And I did another presentation of my work before where I did use slides. I got the kind of feeling that maybe the slides with the text on the screen are actually help understand and follow the text. So I appreciate any feedback. I kind of wanted to favor maybe a more oral tradition, but I think an oral tradition has other requirements for the way the text is actually written. It needs to be a little bit more repetitive and to reinforce itself a bit more if it's purely oral. So any thoughts you can do on that would be useful.
So Walter Ong, a rhetorician, describes that we're in secondary orality. We can never abandon the literate brain that's learned to read from left to right or think in the ways we've carved up the literate world. So that's I think that's an interesting view of the evolution of consciousness in that sense. But I wanted slides for your early readings because I wasn't sure when you were reading, and that's something you can easily, or you could if you wanted to, put at the bottom. So I didn't know you were, I liked that you surprised us that the first, or it surprised me that the first passage was from the Tao Te Ching. I wanted to know when your reading or when your writing was coming in. What was in your voice? What were you authoring a little more clearly? And I also wanted to be able to focus on some of those very strange or unfamiliar words. If they had been spelled out, I think I would have had a different relationship to them. Otherwise, I was trying to parse if I was hearing repetition of names or, yeah, but I love the material. So it works either way, actually, I think, in my opinion.
Yeah, can I add just one small comment? That was my focus too. I picked up on that, Jerry. I think you need to have some visuals. I'm not convinced that there has to be any text on them. What Heather just mentioned with some of the words that are very strange and unfamiliar, maybe. I can let that up to you. But I remember seeing a presentation once at a technical conference, actually, in Berlin on distance learning. And the guy that gave the keynote gave an hour and a half talk. And he showed 180 slides, and there wasn't a word on one of them. But every visual that was there harmonized precisely with what he was saying. And there are visuals in the thing and the things that you were talking about and reading about in Tao Te Ching, for example, even if it's something just familiarly Chinese, helps focus one's attention. And which is what his slides were doing. So something in the background probably might strengthen that a bit, because it's easy to get off track. It's easy to kind of lose sight of where you're going. And I also agree with Heather. When you're speaking, it would be good to highlight that, because it's very clear then what you're saying. So that would be my two cents.
Great. The time I used slides before for my text, I had a lot of people in the audience who didn't speak English. And so they found it extremely useful to have the text on the screen, because for them to follow the English rhythms was difficult. And so I think it's probably a good idea to have some text, but maybe not everything.
No, some of the text would be too long in that regard. But okay. On the other hand, how many participants at the conference are going to be non-native English speaking? It can be a guideline for how much I really have to have there and how much would be effective to be there. Just a thought.
Great, thanks.
I would add to that I would have liked to know where the text was coming from, maybe a little bit more context. You read from the Idle Chronicles, I believe, so some part of your novel. You read poetry that you've published before, that's appeared on the site, or some of it hasn't. So getting more of a sense of you as an author and, you know, what you're working on, what you have in progress, etc. A little bit more of that story would, I think, help to just ground or situate what you're offering. And I would want to just hear it more and really dwell on it a bit more, especially the whale one. That was very, I think, a very resonant kind of image, because brings in the archaic, it brings in the mythic, and so going a little bit more slowly, or like I've had John in the back of my head, chunks down, chunks slowly, I think that would help to more highlight what you're already offering. You know, the texts you're already offering are very rich and resonant, and I think they'll resonate with Heather shares, what I am sharing, and with Gebster's overall theme. But we need a little space to land, I think. And that would come through the context giving, and even through breath, what John was referring to about letting the words kind of, you know, land.
Yeah, so the I do feel the last section was probably too long. The one before the end one, the second to last section was probably too long. And it probably needs some rewriting anyway. So, and I do have the time to comment more, right? So that, just to let you guys know, so the quantum field poem that I read was entirely new. It was composed since last week, essentially, in order to give a voice to the
quantum field ideas in a poetry form. So we discussed that last week. So, yeah.
Sorry, Johnny.
I apologize. I just wanted to say, I know you guys are performing for this medium right here, but you're going to be up on a podium, standing up, presumably, to an audience. So I think it's a different kind of demands. And so I get from Jeffrey a very strong, who's that guy in The Tempest? The Prospero. You know, the Prospero character, the grand magician?
And not Caliban?
No, you're not Caliban. You're not Bottom.
Bottom's a different story.
Who's the one that flies around a lot in that one? The Ariel. You're not Ariel.
Yeah.
No, but there's definitely a Prospero kind of energy I think you would project very well on stage. And I believe that I would like that to happen. Because okay. You have that bass voice. And you also have experience as a singer. So I know you know how to take the stage. So I'm looking forward to seeing the video of that.
I'll think about that, Prospero. Yeah.
I was just going to say, I'd like to, maybe where I have quantum fields and poetics in the middle of my three dots on the Prezi, maybe I would like to read something that I typed up as I started working on this presentation. So it's a kind of a poetic prose piece, and I wouldn't read the whole thing, but I could substitute. I think I can easily cut quite a bit of my content-y stuff. I needed to get clear on it, and I haven't quite gotten clear yet before I could apply it. I'm still trying to grapple with these concepts, and so presenting it, I guess, is one way to do it. but I want to have that flow more smoothly. And then I also thought maybe adding a little bit of my own work would be resonant with the other two presentations.
I think that would
just
be great.
Just a couple minutes. Yeah.
I think that would be great, Heather. I was thinking as you were doing your presentation, I was thinking I have a kind of an unfair advantage over both of you in a way, because this material on quantum field poetics is something I've thought about for a very long time. And so for me, it's assimilated. And so for me to write poetry based on that work is relatively easy, but for you, both of you, it's a relative new idea. So it's not at all easy to sort of move from the theoretical thinking it through part to the actual writing part. So, but if you could do that, I think it would be useful and wonderful, you know?
I like that too. I like the idea that we each share some work, and I think that part of the challenge will be that there's, you know, many different ideas, different theories, different references, histories, and a sort of intersecting fields. So how will we give enough space to each element, you know, so that it can sort of, you know, have its proper effect or have its proper, you know, resonance with the whole. I think part of it has to do with pacing too. It's like this performative aspect of how we pace ourselves and how we transition from one presenter to the other, and the framing at the beginning too. Like that said, that intention is something I wrote down just before we started here. So maybe not stating it in quite that way, or finding it, just giving a little bit more thought to how we transition from that introductory invitation to Jeffrey, you doing your presentation, and then to Heather, and then to myself. Because I think with all those different elements in play, we have to find some like common resonance or some kind of something that can carry and keep the whole thing coherent. It's like there, latent already, but we have to almost just highlight it so that it's that coherence is what shines out or arises out of the kind of shared space.
Well, you guys are going on Sunday, right?
Yeah.
So at some point you have to get together, whether it's up on that stage or somewhere, so that you can physically, literally walk through this, so that you can get a feel for how your bodies are interacting on that same. Here you're talking to the ether, you know. This is very, very difficult to capture that. And there is a different dynamic. It's not just in the words. It's a lot of it is just literally in the gesture, in the movement of the bodies that are visible at that time. That in and of itself provides more of a red thread that goes through things than perhaps the words themselves. You know, the word, and that's part of what you're trying to say, I think, is that the words are secondary in that sense. It's good to have some words. It's good to be able to link up to them. But there's another flow that's involved here, and so you'll need to you need to rehearse that again physically, not just verbally.
Well, it goes further than that, because I guess Marco and Heather, have you actually physically met each other before? I guess, huh?
Yeah.
Whereas I have never met either of them physically, so there's a resonance between the bodies that needs to happen first before we actually go into the shared space together. So I mean, it's part of why the work is so fascinating, because it's not just about the words, it's about the physical presence as well.
And just doing one presentation by oneself is challenging, but the dance that we're gonna be choreographing between the three of us, I think, makes it even more challenging. But you know, we'll have a few days to hang out and chat, and we could set aside some time perhaps just to rehearse in person, maybe not go through the whole thing, or just through the main points, work out the kinks of, you know, the technology and the transitions and so forth.
That was the word that had occurred to me, Marco, choreography. It's, you really have to choreograph what you're doing as well. So, yeah.
There's also, you know about this, Jeffrey, about diffraction. It's a concept I'm just learning about how waves behave. They interfere and they can also cancel each other out, and the waves can also pass through each other. And that idea that diffraction, I'm borrowing here from Haraway and Karen Barad, a physicist, but it's really helped my thinking a lot, that diffraction maps where the effects of differences appear. So I like that idea that you guys are just your waves that passing through each other might cancel each other out, might bring forward those differences. So I believe there's a great deal of coherence already here. And I believe that will get stronger between now and then. Just sleep on it.
Yeah, well, I think it does show that we've been meeting every week for about 5-6 weeks now or something like that. And with Heather and I, a lot longer than that. So I think that shows in the way we understand each other and the way we relate to each other, and even to some extent the texts, right, which have echoes of each other in them.
Something we might
do more, but
we might try over the weekend when we have that time to practice, is Marco and I are part of a facilitation discussion group, and we were led into to drop to the bottom of the U in Otto Scharmer's U theory. And I wonder if we dropped into the bottom of the U and spoke from the dream language, what that might do, with a question about our sense of our resonance or our coherence as a panel. I wonder if we could use that as a practice. I'll facilitate it better, or we can facilitate it better when we when we're in the same space, maybe. But
I'm wondering what that'll be like. Maybe like we become animals of some kind, whales. I don't know. Centaurs. I don't know. We'll see. I think there's something like that, though. Yeah. Okay. Well, we're at the top of the hour. Any more feedback? Any last words before we?
Well, I'm just wondering about the next cafe. If the next cafe happens, we might want to do a follow up. See what you guys learned from the event. It'll be performed on Sunday, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe some kind of report of how the performance went. And we'll also get advantage of seeing the video when it comes out, whenever that is. So I would just, you know, break a leg.
All right, that sounds like a good idea. So a report from the Gebser conference next Tuesday.
Thank you.
That would be fun.
Hey, and Mark, you're in town. Are you gonna?
I can't, I got your invitation, but I really can't drive at night, and particularly in the hostile territory of Boulder.
Okay.
So I just want to echo good luck.
Great.
You know, thank the three you. Of you and have fun. Relax, have fun.
And hey, yeah. It'll be vacation time for me because, you know, I'll be away from, the people are running after me. So
I'd love to be able to meet Jeffrey in person and Heather. I don't know. After if you're still here Monday or something.
Yeah, I'm gonna be there till Wednesday or Thursday. I can't remember. I think I'm going flying back on Thursday. So
like some afternoon
for a coffee or a beer or whatever.
Yeah, that would be great if that's possible.
Yeah,
you guys do what you need to do and then try and have fun.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening and all your helpful comments.
Yeah. Thanks for
coming. I enjoy it very much. Right, see you next time.
Bye.
Go for it. Bye now.